This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Stories. The EU foreign policy chief says the bloc will provide 500 million euros in lethal and non-lethal aid to Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, including warplanes. Iran's security chief says the U.S. presence in Syria is illegal and represents the biggest obstacle to establishment of peace and stability in the country. And Iran's security chief says the U.S. presence in Syria is illegal and represents the biggest obstacle to the establishment of peace and security in stability in the country. I beg your pardon for that. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its fifth day, with fighting expanding to more areas across the country. The Ukrainian government says troops are in full control of the second largest city, Kharkiv, after a Russian attack. Russian forces have targeted a gas pipeline near the city as well as an oil depot near the capital, Kyiv. Moscow says its forces have entirely besieged the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson and the southeastern city of Berdyansk. In Kyiv, the Ukrainian army says it is holding the line around the capital, but it's fighting Russian sabotage groups that have infiltrated the city. It also says a Russian tank company has been destroyed near Kyiv. A senior advisor to the Ukrainian president says Russia is losing initiative in its attack and has suffered heavy losses.
Russia has lost the initiative and is now unable to continue active hostilities. In my estimation, in the estimation of other military experts, the insane losses they have experienced and the resistance of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian armed forces and the thwarted plans of their first 3 days of the campaign show that the further perspective of offensive action in Ukraine is futile.
Ukraine's foreign minister Dmytro Kuleba says Russia's goal is to destroy his country, but he stressed they will not fall and give up a single inch of their territory. In Russia, the defense ministry says its armed forces have hit more than 1,000 Ukrainian military sites since Moscow began its military operation on Thursday. The ministry has also confirmed deaths and injuries among Russian servicemen without specifying. So far, over 350 people have lost their lives in Ukraine. That's according to the government there, and the UN Refugee Agency says nearly 400,000 have fled the country. It says the number continues to rise. Russia's envoy to the United Nations says the ongoing crisis in Ukraine is rooted in almost 8 years of crimes committed by Ukrainian nationalists in the eastern Donbass region.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbass.
Nebenzia also accused Ukrainian nationalists of posing a threat to their own people and civilian infrastructure. He rejected accusations that the Russian military is targeting civilians in its operation in Ukraine. The ambassador also slammed the West's disinformation campaign on the Ukrainian conflict. During the UN Security Council meeting, the U.S. ambassador, however, criticized Russia for what she called an unjustifiable assault on Ukraine. Linda Thomas-Greenfield said Washington would continue to support the Ukrainian government by providing it with additional military aid. Meanwhile, the 15-member council voted to refer a draft resolution on Russia's military operation in Ukraine to the General Assembly. The U.S.-sponsored draft received 11 yes votes. Russia voted against it, while China, India, and the UAE abstained. The Russian president orders his military command to put the country's nuclear forces on high alert over what he calls the West's unfriendly measures.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbass.
Dear colleagues, as you can see, not only do Western countries take unfriendly measures against our country in the economic dimension, I mean the illegal sanctions that everyone knows about very well, but also the top officials of leading NATO countries allow themselves to make aggressive statements with regards to our country. That's why I ordered Defense Minister and Chief of the General Staff to put Russian Army deterrence forces on high combat alert.
Vladimir Putin's announcement drew a reaction from the Ukrainian Foreign Minister. Dmytro Kuleba says Putin's move is aimed at increasing pressure on the Ukrainian delegation. During the upcoming talks, the top Ukrainian diplomats at his country will not give in to Moscow's pressure. The two sides are set to hold talks at the Belarusian Ukrainian border, I should be saying. Earlier on Sunday, Kiev refused to hold negotiations in the Belarusian capital, citing what it called hostile actions from Minsk. Russia's flagship carrier, Aeroflot, says it is suspending flights to Europe after the European Union closed its airspace to Russian aircraft in response to the country's military action in Ukraine. Aeroflot says flights to a European route network are suspended as of Monday until further notice. On Sunday, several European nations, including Germany, Spain, France, and Britain, declared a ban on Russian use of their airspace. Canada made a similar decision. The United States is yet to decide whether it will close its skies to Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. and France have called on their citizens to consider leaving Russia immediately. The European Union has announced that it will supply Ukraine with lethal weapons to fight against Russian forces. That's while critics believe the decision contradicts how the EU has portrayed itself as a peace project. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes tells us more.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The U.S. presence in Syria is illegal and represents the biggest obstacle to peace and stability there. That's according to the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani said the U.S. is looting Syria's resources and attempting to dominate the country. He also said America's measures to arm, train, and direct terrorist groups are a threat to security of both Syria and the entire region. Iran's top security official expressed regret that some of Syria's neighbors are playing into the hands of its enemies. He stressed that plots can be foiled through maintaining national solidarity and the spirit of resistance. Shamkhani was speaking with Syria's National Security Bureau chief in Tehran. Ali Mamlouk hailed Iran's support for Syria in its campaign to counter terrorism and plots hatched by the U.S. and its pawns. Political activist Sarah Flounders tells us how terrorist groups are a means for the U.S. to achieve its end of wreaking havoc in countries.
Well, U.S. policy in Syria and in country after country around the world, where they want to establish a government totally under their thumb, is to use and train with massive supplies of weapons and disruptive forces terrorist groups. And this is what has absolutely been U.S. policy in Syria since 2011, to use every measure to create instability, to create massive waves of refugees and displaced people, and to do everything they can possibly do to bring ruin to the country. Syria has resisted all their plans, sought help everywhere that they could from friendly countries, but fought their own battle to maintain sovereignty. And that is important. And just to take Ali Shamkhani's statement that this is U.S. policy. It's a completely destructive policy, regardless of where they apply it. And for sure, it's been done in a really horrendous way in Syria. But it has not succeeded because there's been real resistance.
Iran says it accepts no deadline for the conclusion of the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says an agreement is possible if the other negotiating sides respect Tehran's red lines. Said Khatibzadeh added that the International Atomic Energy Agency must also close the case of quote-unquote political claims against Iran once an agreement is reached in Vienna. He said the case should not remain as a channel for the agency to exert pressure on Iran in the future. Earlier, Iran's Supreme National Security Council described Iran's demands as legal and rational, warning that the West's unacceptable approach to the outstanding issues can prolong the talks. The comments come as Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani, is heading to the Austrian capital to continue the talks, now in its eighth round. Commentator Robert Fantina says the U.S. is the one that violated the 2015 agreement in the first place, and so it cannot impose an artificial deadline for its revival.
We have to remember that it's the United States and the European signatories who violated the agreement. The government of Iran needs to look at any new proposals, evaluate them to see how they best serve the people of Iran, and act accordingly. And if the United States wants to put artificial deadlines on the negotiations, then the United States can once again walk away from the agreement, because the government of Iran is not going to be forced into an agreement that is not beneficial to it. That's been made clear repeatedly throughout these negotiations and is continued to be made clear.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says Israel is the main culprit behind provoking conflicts in the region.
This is the main instigator to target our nation. The main instigator is the Zionist lobby in the world, and the Zionist entity which stole Palestine and stole parts of our nation and our Arab states is an arm of this Zionist lobby in the world. The Zionist Jewish lobby is what moves America. It's what moves the U.S., what moves Britain, is what also moves in the West to support these stances.
Abdel Malik al-Houthi also denounced the normalization deals between Israel and some Arab nations as an act of treason. He said these Arab countries seek to portray Israel as a friend and tarnish the image of resistance groups. But he added Israel is using them as a tool to implement its plots in the region. Al-Houthi noted that Muslim people will foil such plots through resistance and steadfastness. He made the remarks in a televised address to the Yemeni nation. Public universities across Afghanistan reopen after being closed for nearly 7 months, with male and female students joining classes, our correspondent in Kabul reports.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they are happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban took over. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's about it for me for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Limelight. As the month of Ramadan approaches, all the conditions for another explosion are still in place, says Awad Abdul Fattah Ryder in an article published under the heading "Why Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Could Ignite a New Intifada." Stay tuned for more. On February 14th, Haaretz published an article with the headline, "The East Jerusalem Flashpoint That Could Ignite the Entire Middle East." In it, the journalist Nir Hassoun wrote, Sheikh Jarrah had, again, become the site of violent clashes, just as it did before last year's war. Other Israelis cited similar concerns. The Zionist regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett, himself a right-wing settler, warned far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gvir, who earlier this month set up a makeshift parliamentary office in a tent on Palestinian land in Sheikh Jarrah, that his actions could cause chaos. Bennett on February 14th said, "We don't need provocations from people on either side inflaming tensions for political interest." Given the latest raid by the Zionist settlers on the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah and the violent clashes with its Palestinian inhabitants that followed, the Zionist regime's officials and media's concerns about replicating last May's almost unprecedented Palestinian uprising do not seem far-fetched. As Ramadan approaches once again, beginning at the start of April, there is a huge potential for conflict to erupt around possible Zionist restrictions on Palestinian access to parts of the Old City and Al-Aqsa Mosque during the Muslim Holy Month. Ben-Gvir's act in Sheikh Jarrah, where 27 families have been fighting eviction since 2008, led to violent clashes between the Palestinian families and their supporters and the Zionist regime's security forces. Several protesters were injured while others were arrested. It is this strong resistance by the Palestinian families to the recent assaults by the settlers that has caused Israeli alarm, especially since this renewed local resistance has also brought pressure from Al-Quds-based international diplomats. In the past few months, some Israeli circles held the belief that the popular resistance in Sheikh Jarrah had been exhausted by a number of factors, including the continued Israeli siege of the neighborhood. But the Zionist regime's apparent desire to avoid further confrontation with Palestinians doesn't stem from humanitarian reasons, and Bennett's criticism of Ben-Gvir's provocative conduct is not because the prime minister is any less extreme or aggressive about denying the Palestinian right to self-determination. Rather, it is because, firstly, Bennett sees Ben-Gvir's behavior as directed against his cabinet as part of his infighting within the settlers' camp, split as it is over former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the corruption charges he is facing. Secondly, Bennett is not interested in any disruptions that might embarrass his new allies. For Bennett, especially on the Arab and international scene, things seem to be going pretty well. On the domestic front, he's determined to fight off continued attempts from the right-wing opposition to bring his government down. So the Palestinians are paying the price twice. Firstly, from the ongoing and brutal settler colonial ethnic cleansing project. Secondly, from infighting between the two camps over whoever can be more brutal in implementing the cleansing plans. Last year, almost no one had been expecting scenes of the popular uprising like the ones we witnessed in East Al-Quds, especially centered around one small neighborhood. It was thought impossible that Palestinian resistance could overcome the huge obstacles that have been placed before it physically, with the high separation walls that had been erected, making it difficult to unite Palestinians in one fighting front, and politically, with the security cooperation with the Israeli colonizer. That doesn't mean we will necessarily see another intifada of the same scope and intensify during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan, even though all of the conditions for another explosion are still in place. It could happen before Ramadan, or it could be months or years from now. But one thing is certain, as long as the apartheid settler colonial regime of Israel continues with its injustices, brutalities, and atrocities, the Palestinian people will continue to resist. In recent years, we've seen the emergence of a young generation, creative and brilliant at organizing. They are skilled in using social media to overcome geographic and social fragmentation and reaching out to all Palestinians, wherever they are, as well as to the world. These young people have decided not to wait for traditional leadership to save them, as it has proven incompetent. The birthing of a new leadership is underway. This will take years and will require much endeavor and sacrifice, but that's what the future holds for them, with no other savior in sight. The many minor uprisings, which are led by the youth, are the driving force behind the human rights organizations framing the Zionist regime as an apartheid regime. The Israeli apartheid regime might have a strong relations economically and in terms of security with world regimes. But global civil society is undergoing a significant opinion shift against the fake regime of Israel. At every popular intifada, with every military deployment against Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime comes under fire from global civil society organizations. This is what disturbs the Israeli regime. The Palestinians, and especially the young activists, are confident that the South African moment is coming sooner or later. This hope is what fuels their passion in the struggle for a free Palestine, where justice and equality can prevail on the ruins of the immoral and inhuman settler colonial entity.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, where we aim to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affects the governments, organisations, the people and also the region as a whole. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the simmering row over the US move to split Afghanistan's foreign assets between families of 9/11 victims. And angry protests in Kashmir over burning of top anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani's photo by Indian military personnel.
Afghanistan is an impoverished country teetering at the brink of famine and starvation. The country is desperately in need of foreign aid to stave off a dire humanitarian crisis. People in the crisis-stricken country are tired of decades-long wars, insurgency, foreign intervention and, quote, puppet governments. And with the rampant inflation and businesses in shambles, the Afghan economy is completely falling apart. The country, which heavily depended on foreign aid, has been on the edge since the takeover of Taliban last August. So, what else could disappoint the Afghans?
Afghanistan is a country devastated by decades of war and foreign military occupation. The dire humanitarian situation in the country includes, but is not limited to, hunger, poverty, and a lack of access to life-saving needs. It is while, like other nations, Afghans continue to struggle with the COVID-19 pandemic. Even worse, there are no jobs. A growing number of Afghans, from labourers to university professors, have lost their sources of income and livelihood. Private businesses cannot fund their operations. They have either shut down or laid off their local staff. The case of government organisations is even worse. Foreign aid made up some three-fourths of the budget of the former West-backed government. Following Taliban's sweeping takeover last August, the US and its allies cut off the international aid, and the lack of budget made local organizations virtually defunct. The country's central bank has no access to its own resources to manage the situation. The freezing of assets has spawned what aid organizations describe as the worst humanitarian catastrophe in recent history. While the country's humanitarian and economic crisis continues to worsen, the U.S. administration has displayed utter disdain and lack of apathy, sparking protests in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
On February 11th, the U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order to unfreeze $7 billion U.S. dollars of Afghanistan's foreign assets. Half of the fund will be apparently used for humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. However, the Biden administration will keep the other half, which will be used to cover the judgments from lawsuits that the families of the 9/11 victims had filed against the Taliban. This is bad news for the ordinary Afghan people, as they had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks.
Following the Taliban's seizure of power last year, families of at least 150 victims of the 9/11 attacks staked claim to at least $7 billion in frozen assets held by the Federal Reserves of New York. They claimed that they were awarded the sum by a federal judge in 2012 following a default judgment against the defendants, including the Taliban, Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. The court required the Biden administration to give its position. This is when Biden's executive order was issued stating that his administration will not object if up to half of Afghans' money is awarded to 9/11 families. It made the Biden administration complicit in the possible transfer of Afghan assets to others at a time when Afghans are staring at a humanitarian crisis. His executive order allocates the second half of the humanitarian aid to Afghans. However, it is likely to take months before the assets are unfrozen and handed over to Afghans. Hence, experts feel it will be helpful in addressing immediate needs of crisis-stricken people in Afghanistan. Biden's executive order was met with outrage within the U.S. and abroad. Many termed it stealing and theft. The U.S. administration was urged to reconsider the decision through open letters, as the reserves belong to the Afghan people, not the U.S. or the Taliban.
For President Biden to take half of our national reserves and assign it or dedicate it to those victims is denying the victimhood of the Afghan people, which is wrong morally as well. Therefore, I strongly disagree with this decision. We want the entirety of the Afghan assets to be kept for Afghanistan. These belong to the future generations of Afghanistan. These are the assurance, the sureties for our monetary policies, for the stability of our currency. Therefore, I disagree with it.
Now we are joined by Dr. Mohammad Dawood Miraki to further discuss Biden's executive orders on Afghans' foreign assets. Now, welcome to the program, Dr. Miraki. Now, what's your take on the U.S.'s decision to return a part of Afghans' own assets in form of humanitarian aid?
The irony is this: what the Biden administration is doing is really a highway robbery, a banditry, international banditry, what they have done. They are basically continuing this revenge mode that has, been going on since their retreat from Afghanistan. And they use the excuse that supposedly victims of 9/11 are entitled to the compensation, when in fact Afghans had nothing to do with 9/11. In fact, Taliban had nothing to do with 9/11. And the assets of Afghanistan do not belong to a political group. It belongs to the people of Afghanistan, irrespective of who occupies the throne in Afghanistan. These assets pertains to the economic stability of Afghanistan, and it contributes to the economic stability in Afghanistan, and it does not belong to any political group. And so what they have done is basically adding insult to injury by, on one hand, stealing Afghanistan's assets and then giving it back to Afghanistan. But be happy, this is charity we're giving you to save your lives. So Afghans are not stupid. They understand, they can see through these mockeries and concoctions clearly.
Dr. Miraki, do you believe the Afghan people are central to the U.S.'s aids?
Well, the issue is this: what they are doing, the aid mechanism that they are following, is classic what they do of how they operate almost everywhere. They use NGOs, basically their own, organizations, that have relationship to USAID and to UN and whatnot, and a significant portion of that money is allocated to the NGOs, and NGOs take a significant portion of that for administrative costs, salaries, and whatnot. And then, of course, considering the U.S. history of how it operates and what its plans are, we are not going to be surprised that they do not have an ulterior motive, because during the Taliban insurgency, when the Daesh groups were present in eastern Afghanistan, and Taliban operated and attacked them to destroy them and so forth, and when the conflict ensued, the American planes used to come and used to bomb Taliban fighters in order to rescue Daesh and the ISIS elements. And in many places, when the Taliban encircled them and trying to capture them and decimate them, the Americans would come and airlift them, and they would end up taken care of in guest housing in Kabul and other cities. So considering that history, I would not be surprised, because and another thing we need to also understand that Western intelligence agencies, they have strong relationships to various terrorist organizations, and they use these organizations for their foreign policy motives and black ops. And so Afghanistan is no exception to that. But one thing is for sure, they do realize that 48 countries have tried to submit the Afghans, the Pashtuns that fought against them in the Taliban, but they could not defeat them. And I told them in 2002, I told them anybody can enter Afghanistan, but they cannot get out. And when they get out, they do not walk out. They crawl out of Afghanistan. And that is exactly what the United States have done. They have crawled out of Afghanistan.
So how does the U.S. judiciary system find Afghanistan's official foreign assets relevant to the Taliban while it's not recognized by the administration?
There are two sides of the story. First of all, they realize Afghanistan has a strategic location. It's significant, and they also realize that Taliban is a reality. It's not going to go anywhere soon. It is going to stay there, and irrespective of the United States or anybody else recognize it or not. But the irony is this: the recognition business is led by the United States, and whatever the United States does, the rest of the world follows. This attempt, that the aid that they sent, that's a public relations ploy as well. Remember, there is a starvation going on in Afghanistan, and the United States tries to play down their role in this nightmare that had continued after their retreat. This was a house of cards in economy, house of cards that collapsed and was an artificial arrangement. And once they retreated from Afghanistan, they realized that that their handiwork is going to be visible to the whole world. In order to cover their tracks and trying to say that they have a humanity, they resort to this type of measure. So we send aid and do this and that. I also like to add, the Afghans that they have airlifted from Afghanistan as a way to indicate to the world that they have concern to the Afghan population. They have a lot of young people that, parents send them, because in America it's easy, so they will go there, get educated, and all in all. A lot of these kids, they came here and they're extremely, especially in Chicago, for example, they suffer from extreme depression, and they were telling their sponsors, please send us back to Afghanistan. We don't want America. We want to go back to our parents. But they refused to.
Dr. Meraki, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's take a look at people's reaction to this on social media networks.
Sanjar Sohail is a publisher based in Kabul. He says the Biden administration decision is shameful and disgraceful to both Afghans and Americans. Sabri shares the U.S. forces' pictures with gold bars apparently taken from Iraq. He says, once a thief, always a thief. Mudassir Zawar is a Pakistani student who shares a cartoon of U.S. stealing from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. He calls it the typical American way.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Less than 2 months ago, people in Kashmir marked the second anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's martyrdom with tremendous fervor. But on February 15th, a controversy erupted in central Kashmir's Bugdam district after an Indian military officer was accused of burning a photo of the celebrated anti-terror commander. The incident sparked angry protests in many parts of Kashmir, forcing the military personnel to apologize and reinstall the photos. And the videos and pictures of this went viral on social media.
It all started in Malbuchan village, less than a kilometer away from Magam town in central Budgam district of Kashmir. The Indian forces allegedly entered a residential house to conduct an army census. Eyewitnesses said one of the personnel lifted a portrait of the military commander from the wall and then burnt it. Villagers, boiling with anger, immediately took to the streets. It triggered massive protests in different parts of the Himalayan region. There were also reports of protesters clashing with security forces in the central Budgam district. As protesters upped the ante, the army personnel caved in. Senior military officers visited the place and spoke to the locals. Commanding officer Colonel Rahman was among them. He apologized to angry protesters on behalf of his subordinate. He also raised the photo of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and the leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, as the crowd were heard and seen chanting slogans. Later, the Indian Army personnel accompanied locals to put up replacement pictures featuring Martyr Qasem Soleimani and Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in the area. The army urged people to maintain calm. They also issued a statement saying the matter was being investigated while vowing necessary action if required.
Burning the photo of Martyr Soleimani by the Indian army personnel triggered angry protests in Kashmir days after people in the region enthusiastically marked the anniversary of his martyrdom. So what makes him so popular and revered in the Himalayan region? Spending years in the battlefield to defend the Islamic Revolution and sacred Islamic sites against Daesh Takfiri terrorists, as well as the hapless people in the West Asia region, made Martyr Soleimani a prominent figure on the resistance front. In Kashmir, where people swear allegiance to the Islamic Revolution, he has got legions of followers.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is admired by Muslims across the world. He played a key role in protecting sacred Islamic places in the West Asian region from marauding terrorists. He was ever present on the battlefield, fearless and courageous. He prepared and organized troops for active service, which resulted in the defeat of Daesh Takfiri terrorists. More importantly, he's seen as a hero who stood up for the suppressed people in the entire region. The incident in central Kashmir's Budgam district was not the first time the Kashmiris took to the streets to show their love and respect for the celebrated anti-terror commander. In early January 2020, after his assassination in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad airport, tens of thousands of people in Kashmir protested and burned the effigies of the then U.S. President Donald Trump. Ever since, ceremonies to honor his memory have become a regular phenomenon in the Muslim-majority region. Pro-resistance sentiments are popular in Kashmir. People in the disputed region have become more vocal and visible in resisting Indian rule, especially following New Delhi's decision to strip Kashmir of its semi-autonomy in 2019. Many Kashmiris, like freedom-seeking people around the world, adorn the walls of their homes and localities with portraits of the iconic Iranian general, as well as other leaders of resistance.
Now let's join up with Mr. Sajjad Haidar, editor-in-chief at Kashmir Observer, to get more insight on this rare incident in Kashmir. Mr. Haidar, how often have you seen Indian forces apologize to Kashmiris, and how significant is this?
Well, thank you for having me. So far as your question is concerned, Indian authorities are, they well understand that the Shia community in Kashmir has been, quote-unquote, declared to be neutral in the conflict so far, and they would not like to mess up with this community so that they also turn against the establishment. So this is their thinking, and this by and large also shows that an understanding to the sentiment, religious sentiment, which they think that these are the symbols of Shia revival, and they should not touch with them. Perhaps that was the reason they came out and tendered an apology.
Sir, from your point of view, what makes General Qasem Soleimani so important to the people of Kashmir?
Well, the General Soleimani emerged as a symbol of resistance across the world for all marginalized people, those who stand up to imperialism and hegemonistic policies of the certain Western powers. So there's no doubt in that it transcends borders, and Kashmir is no exception. But in Kashmir, especially among the Shia community, he holds much, important position, and he's highly revered. And his portraits and across Kashmir all over is a testimony to the fact that he's being loved and he's revered, especially for his role he played against the Daesh and other elements and secured the sacred places in Iraq and Syria.
Mr. Haidar, considering this and a like incidents, what is your assessment of the developments in this part of the world, and more specifically in Kashmir?
Well, as I already said, I mean, these are the symbols of resistance, whether it's Imam Khamenei or General Soleimani. You will see people adorn their pictures in their homes and in, the streets in this part of the world. And as I know, in other parts of the world. So the Muslims, especially the Shia community, this has become sort of, symbol wherever they reside. Their habitations are adorned with the pictures of these leaders. And we have witnessed that all along the last several decades, despite the conflict, raging conflict in Kashmir. We never saw Indian authorities or the military, for that matter, intervening in these issues and objecting to these portraits. They are, in fact, you will see them, in places which are very militarily strategically located and very sensitive. In places like Ladakh, bordering China, you will see the portraits of General Soleimani or Hassan Nasrallah or Ayatollah Khamenei there. And military never had an issue with these people because they perhaps understand they are not meant actually to instill that sort of element of resistance as much they are to display the revival of Shia, sort of Shia assertion after long subjugation of centuries. Now they see that there are certain leaders who can stand up to the tyranny and, imperialism and all these things, and they happen to be Shia leaders. And this is one thing that the Shia communities, like in places like Kashmir, with their own troubled histories and the issues, they still come out and, display these pictures. And perhaps the Indian authorities also understand that it's not political motive as such. This is perhaps their assertion. as, you know, because they have been long subjugated and, you know, sort of an underdogs in the Muslim communities.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Haidar for his precious time and knowledge. Now, this rare incident was widely mentioned on social media networks. So let's review some of them.
Said Zafar Mehdi, a Tehran-based Kashmiri journalist, says an Indian military officer was accused of burning Mata Soleimani's photo in Kashmir, which triggered protests, forcing the army men to apologize and put up his photos again. A senior cleric and pro-freedom leader in Kashmir, Masroor Ansari, asserts that people's sentiments are attached with Imam Khamenei and Mata Soleimani, and desecration of their photos cannot be tolerated. Ahmad Ali Fayyaz, a senior Kashmiri journalist, says military personnel should know that figures like Mata Soleimani and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah are heroes for Shias across the globe, including Kashmir. Sajjad Kargili, a Kargil-based political activist, hails Mata Soleimani as a symbol of resistance against terrorism, saying people everywhere are indebted to him for defeating Daesh and defending holy shrines. A multimedia journalist and filmmaker from Kashmir, Said Shahriar, shares a beautiful video clip showing Mata Soleimani's poster somewhere in Kashmir on his first anniversary last year.
And that was our episode covering the US decision on Afghanistan's foreign wealth and the honoring of Lieutenant General Soleimani in Kashmir. Take good care.
In the limelight.
The fast-moving variant poses new puzzles in viral transmission. Several